Hello and welcome to this week's Inside Education, your weekly guide to education matters in Ireland and further afield. You can get in touch with me through Twitter at Inside Ed, by email to insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie, or through the programme's website insideed.com. If you're an educator with a story to tell or an event to highlight, please contact me and I'll do my best to feature it on a future programme. On this week's programme, I bring you the second part of my interview with John Walsh, who for many years was education editor of the Irish Independent and who was also special advisor to former Minister for Education and Skills, Rory Quinn. John Walsh wrote an account of his time as special advisor to the minister called An Education, How an Outsider Became an Insider and Learned What Really Goes On in Irish Government. On last week's programme, John Walsh described how he became an education journalist, how he made the transition from education editor to ministerial special advisor, and what each job involved. We finished up by discussing some successes from Rory Quinn's tenure as minister. We begin this week with an area that was less successful for the minister, that of junior certificate reform. So I asked John, if his job was to save the minister from banana skins, how come he let the minister slip on that one?
40 years ago, there was a report called the ICE report, the Intermediate Certificate of Education, by a group headed by Reverend Paul Andrews, SJ, who's still to the good, I'm glad to say. I remember I was when we were announcing some change in the junior cycle, I was going in early and I was listening to Thought for the Day. I said, good heavens, that's Paul Andrews. I was delighted to hear him. So I contacted him after that and told me we were still trying to get the change that he had been talking about 40 years earlier. We were trying to get it on a reduced basis. What happened? Well, if you go back to the research from the ESRI, which to some extent fed our desire for change, I mean, the research is very clear. It shows that a very substantial number of young people at age 13, 14 switch off in second year, and by the time they get to third year, they're almost lost to the system. I mean, really, can we countenance that and not do anything about it? I mean, one of the arguments was, oh, we can't do anything because we have a recession. I mean, but that's, you know, just keep the head down till the storm blows over. So Rory was determined to try to change it. The initial plan, which was didn't succeed. We modified it, modified again. The intransigence of the ASTI has delayed it and disrupted all the plans. I think people would be hard-pressed to know what the ASTI position is. I genuinely don't know. And I wonder, could you tell me what it is? I mean, they started off on opposition to assessment of their own pupils for state exam purposes. So that was removed. Said, no, there'll be no assessment for state exam purposes. And there isn't. So what's their position now? I don't think anybody's quite clear. There's a disaffection in the ASTI that is very worrying. I mean, it was a once proud and very professional trade union. I lament to say that you could not honestly say that the ASTI is at the vanguard of progressive change or policy in Irish second level education.
Some people would argue that the existence of an exam 3 years into post-primary education in itself could actually be motivating for those youngsters you've talked about who become disaffected with the system.
Yeah, but not the exam as it was, or as it is still. I don't think that it is. I mean, the change that we propose would allow for different modes of assessment, also the introduction of short courses, which I think was a tremendous opportunity for a bit of creativity and flexibility in the system. But unfortunately, that's been stymied to a large extent. I really think it's a shame. I have to commend the TUI for, I mean, their position, to some extent, their position was slightly contradictory. They were initially in favour, then they opposed the change. And then they change their minds again, but at least they're now on the side of the angels in this regard. In fact, I think they would like to be assessing their own students, but as they have done in the past.
So looking back at this stage now, and you've mentioned Solace and you've mentioned the Education and Training Boards, how would you evaluate Minister Rory Quinn's tenure in office?
I think he started a lot, which I think will work its way through over the next decade or so, in, say, solace in the divesting space. I think in the higher education, in terms of the change in the CAO, convincing the universities to have broader entry, to get rid of some of the ridiculous small streams that they have that effectively block off large numbers of students and restrict entry to 10 students just for the sake of having high points. He also introduced politics as a subject, which will happen from next year. He effectively outlawed the practice, as far as we could, of having unqualified teachers in schools. I know there are some obvious exceptions to that, but that's had a very big impact, I think, in primary schools. It sounds simple, but was quite a difficult thing to do, because there was all sorts of knock-on effects in the further education space, where there are still some unresolved issues. He initiated reforms in the College of Education, which have resulted in particular in the establishment of a College of Education in Dublin City University, which is very successful, and is to the credit of Breen de Cran, DCU, that he spent so much time and effort getting it going. I mean, in DCU's case, it has resulted in a massive increase in first preference applications to the university last year. It was the third most popular higher education institution in terms of first preferences last year. He initiated some of the discussion on the introduction of technological universities. Now, I know that's in danger of being upended at the moment because of the provision in the programme for government, which dispenses with the requirement for institutes to merge before they become TUs, and which I think threatens to unravel all that has been done over the past few years. In fact, there's one issue that should be of great concern to the higher education sector. And you have people like John Halligan in Waterford proclaiming that Waterford IT no longer needs to merge with Carlow to become a technological university. You have people like Boxer Moran saying that he's got an assurance that alone doesn't have to merge with anybody to become a technological university. I mean, we're in the danger of a slightly farcical situation of having a number of very small technology universities which have a very small base, won't have enough students, and will, I think, adversely affect the reputation of higher education abroad.
Among those achievements of Minister Quinn, is there anything that you could say, I played a role in that, or that's one that I kind of, you know, I prompted him, or I kind of...
No, I'll tell you one thing I did, actually. I was involved in most of those discussions, but one thing I did... was one particular day when Jimmy Dean and Rory had breakfast in Boswell's, and I was there with Sean McCarthy, who was Jimmy Dean's advisor at the time, and the two ministers clearly wanted to do something about the arts in education. So the two ministers, being good ministers that they were, being very busy, handed it over to Sean McCarthy and myself. So Sean and myself worked on a charter on the arts and education. Spent a lot of time on it. Our ministers were very happy with it. They made some suggested changes in it. The officials, I mean, being officials who were used to dealing in silos, their departments were looked at a bit askance, but once there was a political impetus behind it, took it on board and ran with it. And I honestly think it's having some benefit in Irish education. So I would claim some credit for that. I wonder if one thing that I won't go into.
Yeah, and I mean, indeed, it's something that I've spoken to John Coulhan on the programme about in previous weeks.
He was a great choice. John.
He chaired the implementation of the charter.
Yeah, he did, yeah. He was a great choice. I knew he'd be interested in it. And I convinced him that the department is interested in this now, whatever about in the past, that because there was a minister who wanted to do something for the arts and education, and once there's a minister who's driving something, the officials were like chameleons, will respond. Yes, and they do, and officials do respond when there's a bit of pressure, or from ministers, they do.
Do you have any regrets about the time that you spent advising Minister Quinn?
Oh, I do, yeah. You wish some things went better. You'd wish the junior cycle changes were more readily accepted by the ASTI. That's a big regret. I mean, not so much from a political point of view, because, I mean, as Rory said, look, this is not going to be of any benefit to him, either politically or... but in the long run, it's the students who would benefit from the changes, I honestly believe, that were proposed initially. So that is a big regret. I also regret, I mean, the fact that we had to make some dreadful cuts. I mean, there's absolutely no pleasure in sitting around trying to decide, God, do we cut here or do we cut there? No, ultimately, it's the minister's decision and the cabinet's decision. But I was involved in some of the discussions about where we make cuts. I mean, there's one occasion, another advisor, myself, one official came in and he said, look, you have 5 minutes. I have to find 5 million. What do you want to do? Here, or here. Now we had to run it past Rory, of course, in 1 minute. But so it was a real case of, geez, where the hell do you cut? So it was not easy. And some of the cuts we made were just not good for the system. I mean, the cuts in higher education were not good for higher education. I do some work in that area, and I know the effects of the cuts in higher education. But they were unfortunately essential at the time. I mean, there was a big hole in our cuts in the first year, and we had to find some large spending area. So we had to cut into postgraduate grants. You know. Again, it didn't give us any pleasure, but it was a big block of money that we just had to save. I mean, people forget how close to the precipice we were. I mean, there was one occasion when there was real fear in government and departments that there wouldn't be enough money. We kind of forget that now, and tales of plenty. But it was very frightening at the time in the first year.
And was that partly influenced by the fact that Rory Quinn had been a former Minister for Finance?
How do you mean that?
In terms of he was probably more likely to be compliant with understanding the position of the current Minister for Finance at the time.
Well, no, he accepted his responsibility that he had to make the cuts. I mean, I think ultimately every minister did, except health, but health could never accept it because health is a bottomless pit. No minister has ever seemed to get a handle on spending and health.
You've said already that you regretted that you didn't have more training for the role of special advisor.
I think, because it took me a bit longer to come up to speed with what I was expected to do. But there really is no manual.
But supposing you were put in charge of preparing the advisor to the new minister, Minister Bruton, whoever he chooses, what kind of training would you, or what kind of advice would you give that person before they'd step into the role as special advisor to a minister for education?
Well, I wouldn't presume to tell Kieran Conlon, who's Richard Bruton's advisor and who's followed him from enterprise to education. I wouldn't presume to tell him what to do. The only thing I would tell him is to come to grips with the myriad of organisations, because there's an incredible number. I remember when Eve Brannock became Minister for Education, she decided she'd meet the various players in education. It took her weeks to get through them all. There were just such an incredible number of education bodies. It surprised her. So I tell Kieran to come to grips, Kieran Conlon, to come to grips with that very quickly and to ascertain who you can work with and who you can't work with. Because some organisations are really very open to change, very open to helping. Some of them, I'm afraid to say, are not. You know, that they're defensive, that they're just, their concern is looking after their members rather than looking after the system as a whole, or their pupils if they are a teacher union or managerial body. So find out who we can work with is very important.
And which organisations do you think are important to pay attention to, or which, you know, where are the real drivers that a minister can rely on?
Well, I think for my money, and I've said it before, the best lobbyists in the business by a long shot is the INTO. I mean, they have succeeded in convincing Unionist government to reduce class sizes once again. They are the most effective lobbyists in the business. They really are. I've great time for some of the organisations, the NAPD, I mean Clive Byrne and the National Association of Principals and Deputies is a tremendous, enthusiastic guy to deal with. I've worked with him on a number of issues, not just big kind of political issues, but smaller issues as well, which are to the benefit of the system as a whole. The others as well in the same category. Yeah.
And what is it about the INTO that makes them so effective at lobbying?
Well, I suppose they have one advantage in that they're a couple of advantages. They're a national, but they're national. They're in every town and village in the country. They're well organised. They're dealing really with a single kind of constituency, in that they have a few simple, or not simple but straightforward issues. You know, class size, funding, special needs. So it's probably easier to get those issues across than it is, say, for higher education or further education. I mean, further education is suffering from being underfunded and having a rigidity about teaching contracts. I mean, I was at their conference recently, and that was quite evident. They're doing tremendous work in some further education colleges, but they are very constrained by teaching contracts, you know. I mean, there's enthusiasm for doing a lot of very exciting, interesting projects. So they find it harder to get their message across. Similarly, I mean, I was at another conference organised by the Association of Education Centres of Ireland. And again, they do tremendous work. They're not very well known. But I was trying to convey the message to them about lobbying, about what it is they need and how to go about it, yeah. Yeah. And they do need supports, and they do need to be more open to changing what they're offering in different ways.
Yeah. So you need a clear message. And how important is personality in lobbying?
Personality of the recipient or of the lobbyist?
Well, of the lobbyist, I was thinking of.
Oh, but, yeah, indeed, yeah. I think it's very important. Yeah, I do. I know some lobbyists, I know, probably won't name them, who is a spare of having, not to spare, but just say, oh, God, I'm just going to go on forever. And you're nearly be tempted to get somebody to ring in and say, listen, you have to come to a meeting. Not that I would do such a thing, but... because people... I try to tell them, look, we have a half an hour and that's it, because as an advisor, you're pretty busy, you know. So I would tell people, look, I really cannot give you more than half an hour, or an hour at most, you know, because there's a lot of other meetings backing up. You know.
And given all this myriad of organisations, mm-hmm. and given, you know, the fact that the minister can only do so much, where does education policy originate from?
Well, officials do an awful lot. I mean, we inherited when we came in. I was really surprised at the work that had been done on a couple of issues. Capital assets test was one. Schools admission policy, which I really saw as it could have been Rory's signature legislation if he got it through. God, I was very impressed by the work that had been done on that.
You know. On school missions, was it?
School admissions, yeah.
School admissions.
Enrollment policies, yeah. A huge amount of work had been done on that. And we explained to Roy just how important this is. This could be a really big breakthrough in terms of more greater equality, access to schools and so forth. Because, as you know, there are some practices that really make it difficult for particularly newcomers to an area to get their children into schools. And he did introduce draft legislation, but we didn't get on the statute books, unfortunately. The coalition is now promising, or the Fine Gael minority with the coalition of independence, or independence, as Miriam Lord humorously described them. Has promised to have an admissions and excellence bill, which sounds a bit of a mouthful, has promised to reintroduce it. What shape it'll take, I don't know.
And you mentioned the capital assets test. Yeah. What's that?
Well, This was the idea that we move away from that a single reliance on for higher education grants purposes of income, that you also take into account people's capital assets, you know, because there are the apocryphal stories of farmers, rich farmers getting grants for their children while the poor farm labourers don't, or the publicans who can, and the publicans, the bar men or women can't. I mean, okay, some exaggeration, but nevertheless there's some truth in it as well. We wanted to introduce a capital assets test, which would take that wealth into account, but didn't get very far with it.
And to what extent do you think the Minister for Education can influence what happens in schools?
Well, I suppose through accepting or not the recommendations from the National Council for Curriculum and Assessment, yes, I think that's the main way, or in the case of the attempt to introduce the assessment, if that were successful, the minister certainly would have influenced what happens in schools, or in his introduction of he insisted, even though the money was going to be very tight, on introducing politics into the curriculum as an option. I mean, the officials were not crazy about it, because you do need to prepare teachers for it. But he's always been of the view that it's one of the reasons he encouraged me to write the book, that, you know, people need to know how the system works, warts and all. So to that extent, yes, a minister does influence what goes on in schools, also by guidelines such as the guidelines on bullying, and particularly on LGBT bullying. I mean, it was controversial enough in some respects, but nevertheless it was a very important issue that he dealt with. Well, it's on the whole question of obviously physical education, what happens in physical education. So a minister can influence what happens in schools, yeah.
But the minister is dependent, though, on the buy-in of the various parties. Like, say, if we go back to that, like the ASTI, they didn't buy in. So what kind of, like, the minister then is kind of limited in terms of what instruments he or she can use to bring about change.
Yeah. Indeed, I mean, you can force people, but I don't think a system is good if you have to force people to do anything. You have to try to encourage them, and he was trying to encourage them after their pay was cut more than once, after they had put up with a lot of cuts in funding for their schools. You know, the timing wasn't propitious in that sense. What was he going to do? Wait until it was? But you never get the right time to do anything. Yeah.
And you said there that Rory Quinn agreed with you writing the book, because some people kind of thought maybe, you know, he mightn't like you revealing what did go on behind the scenes.
Yeah, no, far from it. He encouraged me from the very beginning to write it, on the basis that he felt that people should know what goes on and really what works and what doesn't work in government. I mean, he insisted on taking me to a meeting between the hierarchy and the government in the famous Sycamore Room in government buildings. I probably shouldn't have been there. I mean, I wouldn't have been high up the hierarchy enough, but he insisted I go. So I was at the briefing with the Taoiseach first before he went in, and I sat there and was fascinated by the interplay between the bishops and the government. Yeah, well, and he said, you know, there's a chapter for your book, John. So I did refer to it in the book. Yeah.
And did you ever get to sit in on a cabinet meeting?
No, you get into cabinet committee meetings, all right, but not cabinet meetings. No, advisors don't attend. No, cabinet committee meetings. Yes, where I attended the education one, one or two of them from various occasions. Yeah,
And this is not exactly an education question, but since you wrote the book, you saw how the electorate responded to Labour's time in office. Did that outcome surprise you?
I knew they'd take a hammering. I think I was surprised by the extent of the hammering. I think everybody was. I think they, in their worst nightmare, they felt they might come back with 12 seats, but to come back with 7 was a real shock. I I wasn't a member of the Labour Party, I still am, and, but one would have to feel that they did, quote, the right thing by the people, and suffered badly for it. I mean, they were very unhappy from the very beginning with the whole water charge issue. Even before the local elections, when the figure was announced of what it was going to cost, Eamon Gilmore was really unhappy and made it clear, and I've written about that, that he didn't want that issue announced before the local elections. But Fine Gael, they got the figure out, spun it out, and that hit Labour very badly, in the elections. They lost, they were reduced to a third of their local authority seats, and even worse in the general election.
And finally, John, now that you haven't gone back to your role as education editor and you're no longer special advisor, what are you doing with your time?
Well, I'm doing a bit of a little bit of journalism, a little bit for The Independent and for an international publication called University World News. I do a little bit of consultancy work in higher education. I do a bit of pro bono work for one or two organisations, play a bit more golf and tennis.
And I am grateful that John Walsh also gave some time to do this radio interview. John Walsh is a former education editor of the Irish Independent and was special advisor to Minister for Education and Skills, Ruairi Quinn. His account of that time has been written up as a book titled An Education, How an Outsider Became an Insider and Learned What Really Goes On in Irish Government. The book was published by Penguin Ireland. Well, that brings this week's programme to a close. If you'd like to feature an idea or an event on a future programme, you can write by email to insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. Remember, you can listen to podcasts of all previous programmes on insideed.com. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney saying goodbye. Thank you for listening.